Why can't a lady sing this song?
Do-da, do-da.
Camp Town racetrack's 5 miles long.
All do-da day.
I come down da with a hat caved in.
Do-da, do-da.
I go back home with a pocket full of tin.
Oh, do-da day. Wine run all night, wine run all day.
I'll bet my money on the box.
Stephen Foster left us nearly 200 songs, for most of which he wrote the words as well as the music. They include some of the best-known songs in American music history: Camp Town Races, My Old Kentucky Home, Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair, and Beautiful Dreamer. Here to tell us about Foster's life and contribution to American cultural independence is Talking History's Fred Nielsen.
On July 4, 1826, the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson both died. On the same day, Stephen Foster was born. Adams and Jefferson had helped win American independence and shape the nation's political culture. Foster, the country's first professional songwriter, would blend white and black musical forms, and in the process, help create a distinctive American popular culture. With me today to discuss this development is Ken Emerson, author of Doodah, Stephen Foster and the Rise of American Popular Culture. Mr. Emerson, welcome.
Well, thank you, Dr. Nielsen. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Tell us at the start, what was America's popular culture like in the early 19th century? In fact, was there a popular culture?
Oh, there certainly was. People whistled and hummed a Yankee Doodle, and they read Ben Franklin's Poor Richard's Almanac. But popular culture was much more provincial and localized. For one reason is that at that point, America did not have the steamboats, locomotives and trains, telegraphs, and cheap printing processes that were able to link together communities into a larger mass culture. So it was localized at that point. Those innovations did not come along until the Jacksonian age and made popular culture as embodied by Stephen Foster on the broader scale possible. And a second problem, and another reason why America's popular culture back at in the early 19th century was provincial, was because there was no copyright protection. And it was much cheaper for American publishers to pirate English books and sheet music. After all, why pay an American when you could just rip off a Brit for free?
Now, Foster himself was born into a fairly proper white middle-class home, and yet, like kids today, he was drawn to black music, or at least what he thought was black music. What was going on there?
Well, he was attracted, as indeed almost the entire nation was, by the rebellion and the release that imitations of black music offered. It's not unlike a rock and roll or rap music today. He found, as many kids did, that this sort of the genteel culture of the parlor and the ballads sung by the ladies of the house, with the men joining in, were somewhat stifling and straight-laced. It's a little bit like Huck Finn wanting to, you know, go off on the raft with Jim, and or Tom Sawyer wanting to get away from Aunt Polly.
He's torn, though, it seems, as you tell the story of his life, between the music of the parlor, the proper white music with piano accompaniment, and black minstrelsy, what comes to be known as Ethiopian music. What was that conflict all about? Was he able to resolve it in any way?
Well, it was a conflict on a number of levels. First of all, he did yearn for, as a nice bourgeois boy, for genteel respectability, even at the same time as he was rebelling against it. Secondly, he was deeply troubled by what he called the trashy and offensive lyrics of blackface, which is to say, their frequent use, their crude caricatures of African Americans, and the use of the N-word and other various racial epithets, which Foster himself in his earliest songs used. But he felt very uncomfortable with that. And so gradually what he tried to do was to fuse the parlor ballad and the Ethiopian or minstrel song. And he did that partly by elevating the language and the diction of black minstrel songs. For instance, when he wrote the song, Toll the Bell for Lovely Nell, My Dark Virginia Bride, Nellie was a lady, last night she died, no white songwriter had ever called an African-American woman a lady before. And so gradually, culminating in a song like My Old Kentucky Home, where there is no black dialect at all, he tried to sort of elevate the quality of blackface minstrel songs so that they were more comfortable with, compatible with a parlor.
You write in your book, Doodah, that September 11th, 1847 is a firm date for the birth of pop music as we still recognize it today. What happened then?
Well, that was the day when a song was first performed, and that's Oh Susanna, was first performed in public in an ice cream saloon. In those days, saloons didn't necessarily serve liquor. This was also the height of the temperance movement, and ice cream was a common refreshment. But in an ice cream saloon in Pittsburgh, and that was Oh Susanna became the first of Stephen Foster's great hits. It became an international sensation, and obviously even today we can still sing it. And it really embodies the what I would call the sort of the multiracial, multicultural hallmarks of what we recognize as American popular music. That is to say, it's about an African American who has a banjo on his knee as if he were a medieval European troubadour, with a guitar serenading a lady. At the same time, the beat of Oh Susanna is a polka, which at that point was this wild new dance that had gone from Poland and Bohemia to Paris and had recently arrived on American shores. So that the way that this song combines all these different racial and ethnic and cultural threads, I think is prototypical of American popular music.
Before reading your book, I hadn't been aware of the influence of Uncle Tom's Cabin on Foster, particularly in my old Kentucky home. What was that influence all about?
Well, he read Uncle Tom's Cabin. He was not predisposed to approve of its abolitionist politics because Stephen Foster was from a Democratic family and indeed was related to by marriage to President James Buchanan. He was a so-called dough-faced Democrat, as they were called at the time, who would have tolerated any accommodation of slavery in order to keep the Union together. But the story deeply moved him. Not only did he identify, did he feel, being himself a very sentimental person, very moved by the sufferings of the black characters, but also the female character who dies tragically in Little Eva, who dies in the book and is sort of a Christ-like figure, probably reminded him of his own eldest sister who died when he was young, and it died in somewhat similar circumstances, being that she died in Kentucky, and of course the song became My Old Kentucky Home. And so I think that in Stephen Foster's imagination, the stories in the book, in the novel, melded with his stories in his own life. Now, when he wrote the first draft of the song, literally the title of the song was Poor Tom, Good Night. Subsequently, he removed some of the explicit references to Uncle Tom's Cabin, but the song is still about the breakup of a slave family on a plantation, and this family is being sold down the river to harsher circumstances on plantations in the Deep South, as happens in Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Mm-hmm. Well, as is so often the case, the second, third, and fourth verses of Foster's songs reveal more, I think, than what one might get simply from singing along with the first verse. One reads the subsequent verses of My Old Kentucky Home and finds that it's about a slave family that is, as you say, being sold south. The sugar cane shows up in the later verses.
Yes, I think that one of the reasons why the first verse is sort of hooks you into the story but doesn't really tell you is that's how he gets you, which is to say that by writing a lovely melody that really engrosses you, you're in too deep to get it to back out by the time that you realize that the song is quite different. But even today, with My Old Kentucky Home, which everybody sings on Derby Day over mint juleps, you think of it as a celebration of ladies in crinoline and life in the Old South and the mm-hmm. plantation life and Rhett Butler. But it's really quite the opposite, and as such, a very moving song.
Mm-hmm. Now, you make a point of describing Foster as America's first professional songwriter. He makes a decision at a very early point in his life to make his living by making music. How did that decision come about, and was he successful?
The decision came about because he gave away the manuscript to Oh Susanna, to a publisher. He didn't even know that it had any monetary value. Because at that point, the profession of being a songwriter did not really exist. People who wrote songs supported themselves either by performing them, like a rock star today, by giving music lessons, by running a music store. But when a publisher made a lot of money off of Oh Susanna, he realized, hey, maybe there's something here. And so he did make the rather audacious decision to become a full-time songwriter. It was, in some ways, as presumptuous as somebody in the 1940s deciding to become an astronaut. The profession literally did not exist. He was, however, successful for the first, well, let's say, 10 years. Modestly successful, but enough that he could keep his, he married shortly after becoming a songwriter, and he was able to support his wife and daughter. But the hits stopped coming, and he got further and fell further and further in debt. And in some ways, it was simply, it's like the Internet and all the dot-coms that, you know, have gone belly up, which is to say popular music was had not yet developed infrastructure to support people. I mean, that's why, I mean, he was, because in as much as he was one of its creators, and the business was still in its infancy, in the same way that all these people who are doing creative work in dot-com businesses, most of them haven't figured out actually how to make money from them yet. In 10 years, they will. Just as songwriters, the next generation after Foster, the smart and cagey ones made a great deal of money.
He writes, through much of his career at least, two kinds of music. Sometimes he fuses them, but often one can see a distinction between the parlor songs and the so-called Ethiopian songs. Is one genre more successful for him than others?
Yes, the so-called Ethiopian songs, which then became called plantation melodies, were much more successful during his lifetime. I mean, today we think of Foster and we think of I Dream a Genie with a Light Brown Hair or Beautiful Dreamer as big songs, and they certainly are famous, but they were not terribly successful, you know, successful during his lifetime. As a matter of fact, Beautiful Dreamer was published posthumously, and I Dream a Genie was a minor hit at best. And this was frustrating to him in some senses because it's sort of like the clown who wants to play Hamlet. He had so much success with his blackface songs that but he kept trying to write, and this also contributed to his downfall commercially, is he kept trying to write ballads, parlor ballads, but they did not, you know, recoup, they did not earn the kind of royalties that his blackface songs did.
You're currently, I believe, researching the Brill Building. This is the building in New York City where songwriters like Carole King and Neil Sedaka worked in the 1950s and 1960s. I'm curious, now that you've looked at both centuries, how did the production and consumption of American musical culture change in the period from Foster to the Brill Building?
Well, first of all, you could make money doing it. Referring back to my this what we were just talking about an industry that not yet developed an infrastructure. By the 1950s and 60s, the period I'm talking about now, there was this infrastructure, but there was also something actually quite similar in a way. And that is, this was the beginning of rock and roll. And in the same ways that Stephen Foster took minstrel music and blackface minstrelsy and made it respectable and even made it commercially successful for middle-class people, the New York songwriters took rock and roll, the sort of the crude raucousness of rockabilly, and dressed it up. I mean, they added strings, for instance, to all the great Drifter songs, which scandalized most fans of rhythm and blues. So in the same way that Stephen Foster made minstrel music for the white middle class and respectable for the white middle class, so too did a lot of the New York songwriters make rock and roll respectable for a white middle class audience.
You have a beautiful paragraph in your introduction. You say that Foster is so absorbed in the air that we breathe and in the airs that we hum that we seldom, if ever, think of him. Yet an America without Foster is as unthinkable as an America without Whitman or Twain, without Louis Armstrong or George Gershwin, without rock and roll, without racism. Could you elaborate on that, if you would?
Well, that really is the reason why I wrote the book. And as a matter of fact, that paragraph is a paragraph that I wrote almost before I began the book. As a writer, I've always been interested in looking at our racial, the tangled, torturous racial complexity of America. And I felt a challenge as a writer and also a challenge as an American to try to understand our culture and not to sort of sweep it under the rug of political correctness, or for that matter, political ignorance and incorrectness. talking about Foster is difficult. It's especially difficult talking about Foster with African Americans, to whom he is a very powerful, hateful symbol. And any African American over the age of 40 has painful, humiliating memories of being forced to sing Old Black Joe in school. But on the other hand, this music has endured in a way that the more hateful racist music of the minstrel era has not. And I wanted to try to get at this, and one of the things that when I discuss this with African Americans, or especially in African American classrooms with kids, is the music racist? Of course it is. So is American history. So now, what do we do with it? And I want simultaneously to sort of look at the music, warts and all, to discover, as well as warts, its beauty. And I think this is one of the appealing things about popular culture in general. It does reflect our history and what's really at the heart of our lives and our minds and our souls, and that's why it's popular.
We have only about a minute or so left. There are fewer pianos in American living rooms now than there used to be in Foster's time. As you've just mentioned, many of Foster's lyrics are deeply problematic, racially offensive. Does he still have a place in our culture in the 21st century?
Oh, I think remarkably so. As a matter of fact, one of the songs, I mean, that he wrote, Hard Times Come Again No More, which was a modest hit in his own lifetime, has been recorded in the last 10 years by almost everyone you can think of. I mean, Bob Dylan, Emmylou Harris, the opera baritone Thomas Hampson. It was the beginning number and the ending number of the film Georgia, starring Jennifer Jason Leigh. And one of the reasons why Foster's music has a place in our culture is that it is so incredibly elastic and flexible that people can adapt it to their own purposes. You can do Stephen Foster music as country music. You can do it as pop music. I mean, you think of Ray Charles's first great hit, actually, the first hit by Ray Charles, one of the great rhythm and blues and soul musicians, that was a hit on the white charts, was Way Down Upon the Suwannee River, the Suwannee River Rock. And his previous songs, because he did not have melodies or references that were immediately identifiable to whites, were strictly on the R&B charts. But Foster is continually being rediscovered and reinterpreted in ways that make him come alive.
Mr. Emerson, thank you for speaking with us today.
It was a pleasure. I enjoyed the conversation immensely.
You've been listening to Ken Emerson, the author of Doodah, Stephen Foster, and the Rise of American Popular Culture.
Beautiful dreamer, wake unto me. Starlight and dewdrops are waiting for thee. Sounds of the wood. By the moonlight have all passed away.